It's time for Let's Talk with Brian Pettaway.
Good morning, happy Sunday, and welcome to Let's Talk. I'm your host, Brian Pettaway, and I will be with you here for about an hour or so, as I am every Sunday, and I thank you for being here. We've got a great show today, and I've got a great guest, someone I'm very, very honored to have with me. His time is highly in demand. He is a well-accomplished and very well-known pastor. He's been with the same church down in Texas for 40 years, and he's still a young man. He's going to talk to me about several things. I'm going to ask him a myriad of questions about what's going on in the black church. If there's anybody to ask, it's him. In addition to those things, he's also a doctor of theology, and he's got incredibly huge shoes to fill because now he has taken over the Rainbow Push Coalition program that was founded by the Reverend Jesse Jackson. So yeah, he's a leader in the black community, and he's also a huge, huge leader in the Christian world. And I do have the Reverend Dr. Frederick Douglass Haynes III with me. Of course, I've got the Petty as well. He's going to break down what's gone on in the sports world this last week. But before any of that, you've got me. I love to do what I love to do, and that is give you news and commentary with some of the stories that I have found interesting over the last week. So I hope you're feeling great, because I'm feeling great. I've got lots to talk about this morning, so let's get right to it. Well, apparently there is some progress being made with the Baltimore Gun Buyback Program. Cars lined up last weekend in the Edmondson Village parking lot in southwest Baltimore with people eager to give up their guns for cash. The program was supported by, in partnership with, the Archdiocese of Baltimore. And the goal, of course, was to get as many guns off the street as possible. And the effort wasn't too bad. Actually, they collected more than 300 firearms, including 17 semi-automatic weapons. Local parishes raised more than $50,000 to make the gun buyback program possible. And the guns were purchased by the BPD with no questions asked for $200 or $300 cash, depending on the weapon that was turned in. All of that $50K was used up last weekend, and all of the guns will now be destroyed. Now, I definitely applaud the effort, and this is a great step in the right direction, but I'm hopeful also that we can find a way to determine where these guns are being smuggled into the city from. We all know that the youths that are carrying these guns and the ones who are committing the crimes are not the ones who are manufacturing these guns or the ones smuggling them into the city in large, large quantities. Also, the BPD is reporting that skeletal remains were found in a suitcase last Sunday morning in the 2400 block of East Madison Street. The remains were given to the medical examiner's office to determine the cause of death. Now, anyone with information about this case is asked to call Metro Crime Stoppers at 866-7-LOCKUP. That's 866-7-LOCKUP. And of course, your identity will be kept anonymous. Now, this next story is something that has bothered me all week. I mean, it's really been on my mind. I do know why. And it simply just shows a huge light on the lack of compassion in the justice system for those persons with little money. I mean, it really, really does. You decide. I mean, I'm hoping that something changes good for this young lady, something that is permanent. But thus far, that has not happened. But a Baltimore woman, Deanna Woodward, is being forced to leave the home that her family has lived in for 50 years. Now, Deanna found out that her home was sold out from under her by a New York investment firm in 2018, even though Deanna paid off the home free and clear in 2017. Now, the reason is because of an outstanding water bill that reached $1,700 due to what Deanna says was a broken water pipe that the city did not take care of. And when she tried to go to City Hall to set up a payment plan with $150, she was told that it wasn't enough. What Deanna and a lot of homeowners in Baltimore City are not aware of is a law that allowed homes that has a final notice bill of $750 or more can be sold by the city without the owner's notice, even if it was owner-occupied, meaning even if the family that owns the home is living in the home. And that's exactly what happened to Deanna and her family. A New York investment company bought the home in 2018 for $10,000 and then sold it in March of this year to a Baltimore investment company for $49,500. And each sale happened without any notice given to Deanna Woodward. And even though she paid this house off free and clear a year before the sale, she was not given one red cent for the sale of her home. In fact, the only way that she knew that this sale had even transpired was because the sheriff's office of Baltimore City knocked on her door last week and told her that she was being evicted by the investment firm in Baltimore that purchased her home. Thiro Vignaraja, representing Deanna, said that he tried to stop the eviction, but the judge made a decision that lacked compassion and sided with the investment firm to evict Deanna and her family last Monday. Mayor Scott changed the owner-occupied law in May, taking those properties off the tax sales list, but it's too little too late for Deanna, and she says she now has nowhere to go, and she and her young son will now have to go to a shelter. Upon hearing the story, Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott and other city officials have tried to stop the eviction themselves, but so far the order to evict stands. The family's attorney, Thero Vignaraja, did file an emergency order on Monday on Wolfer's behalf, asking the judge to pause the eviction, and so far that's worked, but it's only temporary. And the fate of this young lady and her home still rests in the court, which to this point has shown very little compassion in the situation. And I'm hopeful that the judge and the Baltimore investment firm that purchased her home can work something out with Deanna Woodward, and she'll be able to stay in that house. I don't know what that plan would be or what it would look like, but I hope that they can find something and work something out. And speaking of court cases, according to Fox 45, in the ongoing saga of the court case of former Baltimore City State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby, federal prosecutors said the court should not move the trial based on the publicity that her former attorneys attracted to the case. Prosecutors said on Friday in a filing that the court should not allow the defendant to conjure up a storm and then complain that her roof is leaking. The filing continued to say that this case should be tried in Baltimore where the crimes occurred, the defendant is located, and the witnesses are nearby. They said courts have declined to move other high-profile cases, and note that half of the jury pool in the Northern District, according to her attorneys, are not even familiar with who Marilyn Mosby is. Marilyn Mosby's defense team is petitioning for a delay in the trial, asking for a change of venue because they believe that Marilyn Mosby will not receive a fair trial because of all the publicity and the media attention that has been given to this case. The prosecution is saying that the defendant should not be able to create and encourage media coverage and then complain less than 90 days before the trial of the same media coverage she has spent many months encouraging. Now look, I'm not an attorney or a judge, but Marilyn Mosby was indicted on these charges in January of 22. We are a year and 8 months past that indictment date. And both the prosecution and the defense are guilty of delaying this trial. It is way beyond the time where this judge should say, listen, it is what it is. We're starting this trial no matter what, and we're going to do it in the venue in which it was originally set. I don't understand what the problem is, but I do know that this trial needs to start and it needs to be over. Because most of us, frankly, don't even care about this trial anymore. And in national news, in case you've been living under a rock for the last 6 days, there was a brawl in Montgomery, Alabama that started between a group of white boaters and one black cruise boat dock worker. The video has gone viral, and it's been a part of every news broadcast for the entire week. And if you've missed it, please go online and look it up. And, you know, I'm not one who condones or encourages violence, but I am one who condones and encourages unity, especially in the black community, because there's been a huge lack of that, by design, I believe, in this country for a long time. Basically, what happened was a black dock worker who was responsible for making sure that the riverboat cruise ship, ironically named Harriet, docked so that passengers can get off and new passengers can get on. However, a group of white boaters had parked their pontoon boats in the area in which the Harriet was supposed to dock. The black dock worker told the white boaters to move their boat, and when they refused to do it, he took it upon himself to pull the boats out of the way himself, which infuriated the white boaters. Now, before I continue with the story, there are two things you have to know, and one is that these boaters had been drinking, and the other is that former President Donald Trump had held a rally in that city not more than 24 hours before this took place, so, you know, you kind of know where I'm going with this. Well, when the black dock worker confronted these guys again, it became physical, and one of the white boaters grabbed the black dock worker by the throat. The dock worker took his hat off and threw it up in the air, some saying that it was the bat signal or the black signal, and started to defend himself. Well, then three or four other white guys jumped in, including a white woman, and they took him to the ground and started beating and kicking him. And in other situations similar to this is typically where the story ends, except we're hoping that police come or security comes and they sort it all out, and usually we get the short end of the stick, right? Well, not this time. Unfortunately for these white boaters, the riverboat Harriet was full of black passengers waiting to dock, and the dock was full of black passengers waiting to replace the passengers that were on the cruise ship. Black people came from everywhere, or at least it seemed that way. One 16-year-old passenger of the Harriet dove off of the riverboat and swam to the dock to help the dock worker because the boat wasn't docking fast enough. To make a long story short, black folks put a beat down on white folks that day, and it was glorious to see, not because of the beat down, but because of the unity which it represented. So Again, if you have not seen this video, please, please, I encourage you to go to YouTube somewhere. You can probably find it anywhere at this point and look at it. Now, several people were arrested, and the four white voters who originally jumped on this black dock worker, three men and a woman, have been charged with a crime. And one of the black passengers of the cruise ship was also arrested and charged with a crime for using a folding chair to beat two of the white voters. There are going to be several legal issues to come out of this situation that we must support. There have been two heroes that have come out of the situation. One, the 16-year-old kid that dove off of the riverboat and swam to the dock. He's been deemed a hero, and he has already issued a statement from his publicist saying that he is overwhelmed with gratitude for the support and love that has been shown and thrown his way. But he was only doing what he was raised to do, and that is to do what is right. And the other hero has yet to make a statement, but we expect to be hearing from the folding chair any day now. All right, we're going to shift gears and come back and speak to my esteemed special guest for this week right after this.
Sean E. Merriman presents An Evening with Kiki Wyatt. Kiki Wyatt.
We'll be loving to the brink of the day.
With her special guest, Keith Washington. And the sultry Miss Crystal F. Saturday, September 23rd, 6 p.m. at the James Weldon Auditorium at Coppin State University. Get your tickets at SeanEMerriman.com. This is a Ticketmaster event.
As I mentioned, I do have an incredibly special guest here today. I'm honored to have this guy. He is and has been a great leader, not only in the Christian world, but also in the black community in general. He has been a pastor at the Friendship West Baptist Church in Dallas, Texas for the last 40 years. And he is, you know, a passionate leader, a social activist, an eloquent orator, and an educator engaged in preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ. He's also engaged in fighting against racial injustice, and Dr. Haynes is also committed to and has devoted his life to economic justice and empowerment in underserved communities and touching and transforming the lives of the disenfranchised. During his tenure as pastor at Friendship West Baptist Church in Texas, he has taken the church membership from less than 100 members in 1983 to over 13,000 today. He has earned a Master of Divinity degree from Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, received his Doctor of Ministry from the Graduate Theological Foundation, and is currently a Doctor of Philosophy PhD candidate at the Christian Theological Seminary in Indianapolis, Indiana, where he is also studying African American preaching and sacred rhetoric. And as if that is not enough, with all of that going on, he has recently accepted the honor of taking over the Rainbow Push Coalition as president, replacing the founder and now former president, the Reverend Jesse Jackson. Now, I could go on and on and on about the achievements and credentials of this gentleman, but the more I read about him, the more I start to develop an inferiority complex and feel like a huge underachiever, and I don't need that today. So what I'm going to do now is stop reading about him and start having a conversation with him. So 1500 Radio family, please help me welcome to Let's Talk the Honorable Reverend Doctor and now President of the Rainbow Push Coalition, Frederick Douglass Haynes III. Okay, good morning, Dr. Haynes. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Brother Betterway. How about yourself? I'm doing well, thank you.
I am hanging in there. Again, I'm really, really happy we were able to get you. Thank you so much for joining me today. Sunday is always a great day, but you've made it greater this morning to have you with me today.
Well, it's my honor. I appreciate the opportunity to share with you and your global listening audience.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. You know, a lot of people know who you are. Many, many. In fact, when I told people that I might have an opportunity to interview you, they're like, wow, really? Wanting to know how I landed this interview. Because you are in high demand. You got a lot of things going on. So I'm just trying to figure, can you tell my listeners exactly what's going on with you right now? Like, how are you spending your days?
Again, I want to thank you so much for this opportunity to share. Most of my days are spent I'm really in a transition season. I think, as many people know, the icon himself, the Reverend Jesse Lewis Jackson Sr., who is one of the greatest leaders in the history of our nation, one of the greatest leaders in the world, has ask that I succeed him as the president and CEO of the organization that he founded and gave such life to, liberating life to, Rainbow Push. And
right.
So I am balancing continuing my responsibilities as pastor of Friendship West Baptist Church, where I've been pastoring for 40 years now, and now trying to survey and get a sense of the lay of the land, as they would say, of Rainbow Push, the organization Rainbow Push. And not only that, but trying to see how we are going to, on the one hand, continue the great work the Rainbow Push has been known for, but at the same time, expand the work for such a time as this, because Rainbow Push through the years has, in an unprecedented fashion, picked up the mantle of Martin Luther King Jr. in his
right.
last days, as he was, you know, pushing for economic justice. And so that need is greater now in 2023 than it was in 1973. I think we've heard the stat that in 2053, the net worth of black people in this country will be zero. The wealth gap between whites and blacks is 10 to 1. The income inequality that exists now is continuing to spread. So the push for economic justice is something that I'm looking at every single day, what we can do now to ensure that, as Reverend Jackson often said, we don't receive charity, but parity.
Right.
At the same time, Reverend Jackson began this great work when it comes to educational justice. And with the attack on education that's taking place in this country, again, that legacy we must continue. What we have to add to it, though, is the fact that, as we all are witnessing, this planet is experiencing a slow burn, its own mm-hmm. fire.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, oftentimes the rich create the pollution that the poor have to inhale.
Right.
And so, as David Williams says at Harvard, our life expectancy is not determined by our genetic code, but by our zip code. And so we have to be on the front lines in the fight against environmental racism. So when you ask me what I'm doing these days, I'm trying to, on the one hand, continue our work as pastor of Friendship West. I have a great congregation I love so much. At the same time, survey what do we have at Rainbow Push, and what do we need to be doing, as scripture says, for such a time as this?
You know, Doctor, you are a pastor of a pretty large church. We have like 13,000 members now or something to that effect.
Yes, sir.
You've got a pretty large church. Didn't start off that way. You actually grew it to that point in the 40 years that you've been there. So that's an amazing feat in itself. But I got to ask you, being a pastor of a church, do you find it inappropriate, or, because I know we used to do it back in the day, but do you find it appropriate to speak politics within the congregation, within the doors of the church? I know the extreme evangelical right, they do it, but how do you feel about it?
Well, I think that, number one, when you look at the history of the black church, as Henry Mitchell said, the black church, when it was born in on these shores, every pastor made it her or his business to transform their pulpit into a platform for abolition.
Right.
That meant that they were speaking to the systemic injustices that their members were experiencing every single day. And so the pulpit became a platform for addressing those injustices. So when you look at the roots of the black church, we were born addressing issues that some like to label political. I prefer to label it justice seeking, liberation seeking.
Okay.
And I think we often, you know, label it political in order to make it a bad thing, when you look at it, you know, and let's go back to Jesus.
Okay.
His inaugural message, he says, "The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because he has anointed me. The Spirit has anointed me to preach good news to the poor, the gospel to the poor, and the gospel in that day had not been watered down to what we like to do it today, how we like to water it down today. The gospel in biblical antiquity had to do with the concrete liberation or good news in bad situations mm-hmm. that were political, that were economic, that were social. And so we've spiritualized a term that was really social. And so, as the late William Augustus Jones said, the gospel has always been spiritually social and socially spiritual. And so, again, I follow Jesus, who was anointed to preach good news to the poor, set the captives free, heal those who were broken, open the eyes of the blind, deliver the downtrodden, proclaim the year of economic justice. And then, toward the end of his ministry, Jesus says, in the judgment, I'm going to separate the nations, like the United States from Russia, China from Japan. I'm going to separate the nations. And when I divide the nations, I will divide them as sheep from goats. And I'm going to divide them according to how they treated when I was in prison, when I was hungry, when I was thirsty, when I was a stranger. If he's talking about nations, he's talking about policy.
Right.
Policy has to do with politics. Right. And politics, one definition is the distribution or the art and science of distributing resources. Now, if politics has to do with distributing resources, and my Bible says the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and they that dwell therein, shouldn't God have something to say about how resources are distributed? And according to scripture, God wants to make sure that those who are last left behind, those who are disinherited and dispossessed, that they get their fair share. Now, some people call it politics. I call it divine justice.
Well, you make an excellent point, and that's what I was going to ask. I find that a lot of the churches, a lot of black churches, where pastors have a perfect platform in which to inform the congregation, kind of shy away, and I don't know if it's because, you know, it's a tax exempt scare, or I don't know what it is, but that used to be where we got all of our social information.
Exactly.
And is do you find that that's something that you should or could or will go back to? Because we are being misinformed every place. So I'm just trying.
Without a doubt. Well, and the members of our church will tell you, and those who've heard me will tell you, that that's nothing I've ever shied away from.
Okay.
I do believe that I come from that tradition that, you know, raised up a Martin Luther King Jr., a Jesse Jackson, a Henry McNeil Turner, and Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, and all of them recognized our responsibility to not only speak truth to power, but to empower those who were powerless in the pews,
right,
by telling the truth and by giving a sense of what is going on in the world through the lens of the gospel, because again, faith must work in the world. We don't have faith that just works on Sunday. My question is, how do I live out my faith, you know, Monday through Sunday?
Go. Exactly.
And that is what we have to get from the pulpit during the week. And so the black church, again, at its best, has always been that space, that sacred space, where we received not only inspiration that would get us to heaven, but also information so we could access the power of heaven to deal with the hell on earth.
Absolutely. Amen to that. I have another question for you. I had the Reverend Dr. Jamal Bryant on his show not long ago, maybe 2 or 3 months ago, and I asked him what his inspiration was to get into pastoring, and I thought it was because of his father, and he said no. He said initially he wanted to be an activist. He thought his calling was to be an activist, and but then he felt that he was called to preach the word of God. Now, he's kind of combined the two, but you've taken it to a whole nother level because you certainly have been pastoring for 40 years or more, but now you're about to step into these big shoes with the Rainbow Coalition, and they are big shoes to fill. How do you feel you'll be able to balance those two? Because those are very, very demanding positions on both ends.
Well, I mean, two things. Number one, the good news is, as Reverend Jackson said to me during our negotiations, I was really already doing this work. That's one reason why he, you know, came to me to ask me to succeed him, because I was leading protests in Austin, in D.C., in Dallas, and we have fought against economic injustice as seen in economic predators such as the payday and car title loan stores. We have stood against, you know, the governor of this state who's trying to be the grand wizard. Mm-hmm. And we stood against his, you know, intent to suppress the vote. And we have fought against that while at the same time, you know, being one of the leading voter registration vehicles in the state of Texas. So this is kind of work I've already been doing, and the church has been very supportive of it. Now with Rainbow Push, there's a larger platform right. to get done what I've already been doing. So on the one hand, it's really not going to be problematic because the church is used to me doing this. And then the second piece has to do with the fact that, you know, fortunately, during these 40 years, I've been blessed to build the type of ministry and congregation and staff and infrastructure whereby they give me the freedom to do this kind of work. And so I know it's a lot of work, but again, it's work that I've been prepared for because it's work that I've already been doing.
Yeah, you I guess, founded a group or started a group or program called Thrive. Tell me about that. Right. How did that start?
Well, this started during the Obama administration, because I'm trying to remember the exact year. But one of the things that happened is that there was, of course, the tragic murder, even though he wasn't convicted, but the tragic murder of Trayvon Martin in Florida.
Right.
And in the aftermath of Trayvon being killed, I was asked to speak at a church, a white church in North Dallas. And they asked me to talk about the role of the church in the age of Trayvon Martin. This is a white church that asked me to do this. And okay. So I said, if they want to hear it, I'll bring it. And so I did. And then afterwards, we had a Q&A, and one of the questions had to do with, so what are we supposed to do with this? What practically can churches do? And so, again, this is off the cuff, and my response was that when I was coming along, growing up in San Francisco, every summer I had a job, and it started with a program, a CETA program that the government funded. And the program operated out of my home church. And so this CETA program gave me some, you know what, responsibility, but mm-hmm. also resources. Okay. And I never will forget that summer, as the summer was ending, I'm getting ready to go back to school. I had money in my pocket to buy my school clothes. I had money in my pocket to do what I wanted to do. And so my challenge was that we may need to go back to that, and that is churches and government forming partnerships so that those who don't have access to resources, those who find themselves without job opportunities, that they have that because of the church that's in the community and government resourcing it. So after I say this, you know what I'm saying, like, I can't just talk this and not walk it. And right. that's how we started the Thrive program, because I just felt challenged, because I'm talking all that smack, but then, okay, what am I going to do this summer for our boys?
Right.
And so we started the Thrive internship program, and man, what we did, I reached out to every business that claimed they liked the ministry that we were doing and engaged in. And I said, okay, I need you to give me 5 jobs. You to give me 5 jobs for young men making $15 an hour. And this is, again, 2013, 2014.
Okay.
And I said, they have to make $15 an hour. And that's just the way it is. And so we started out with over 100 young brothers who, you know, between the ages of 13 and 17, you know, they got jobs making $15 an hour. And many of them were so good and so effective that they kept the jobs as after school work once school started. And, you know, some of them now, you know, because again, that was all those years ago.
Right.
They are doing really well in various areas, even some on the same, in the same company. And so, needless to say, at about 2 or 3 years in, I got word that some of the, you know, sisters were mad at me, like, okay, how are you going to do this just for the brothers and not the sisters?
Right.
And so I could not. You know, I got a daughter, I have a mother, I have a wife, I got three sisters. And so I said, okay, so I cannot be chauvinistic or sexist. We got to make room for our sisters. And so that expanded. And now we have young men and young women who are in the internship program, and we're very proud of them.
Did you have a criteria that these young men had to fill? How did you vet 100 young men to be able to vouch for them at a business? You know, there is risk involved in that.
Oh, yeah, no question. So what we did, and again, I say we because by now I'm backing out because I may cast a vision, but I need people with skills to connect the dots. And so what they did was basically to provide the training because we were determined that no one be denied the opportunity, but we were responsible for training them, giving them etiquette for work before they were able to, you know, go receive the job or apply for the job that they were guaranteed to receive. So I can't take any credit for that. I had an amazing team that said, Pastor, this is a good idea. But, you know, these young kids, a lot of them are coming from circumstances where they've never been exposed to etiquette. And so we're going to train them. And when they are ready, we will release them to go to work. So, yeah, that's how that works.
I asked that question, Doctor, because, you know, I'm sure that you are familiar with Baltimore and the crime that goes on here in Baltimore. And the crimes are being committed by younger and younger and younger young men, right? And so I'm trying to figure out how do we get the churches, because obviously we're not being able to rely on city government. So how do we get the churches? And I see that you're Greek, or even some of the fraternities, the black fraternities, to involve themselves in this issue and start systems like this within the church or within the even the Greek organizations, because we need it. We absolutely need it.
Right. Well, and again, for me, it's all about partnership. And when we recognize that there is a crisis, because that was one of the things that, you know, we tried to, and I won't say cash in on as much as take advantage of, and that is when Trayvon Martin was killed, it struck a nerve with people.
Right.
And for a white church to invite me to speak and address it, you know, for me, it was important to take advantage of what Shakespeare would call that tide in the affairs of men and take it at the flood so that we could create an opportunity. And so I would just say it's very important to recognize that there is a problem. And then number two, to form partnerships, because we could not do this as a church by ourselves. It took reaching out to corporations. It took reaching out to, at that time, the mayor of the city, and, you know, pushing the mayor to develop a jobs program. And so all of that was because, again, there's no one entity that can do this.
Right.
The churches are in the community. Fraternities and sororities have connections. The government has resources that come from our taxpaying dollars. And so when you bring all of those entities together, corporate, business, government, churches, social organizations, when we form partnerships, then stuff can happen. But as long as we think we can do it in our various silos, and the sad reality is we don't learn the wisdom of Mayor McLeod Bethune, who said, if I try to tap you and get your attention with one finger, it may happen. two fingers, I'm not sure, but you let me form a fist with five fingers, then a fist has power that those fingers by themselves don't have. And so all I'm saying is that the church is a finger. Business is a finger. Government, a finger. And I could just call the roll. If we form a fist, then we can actually do some serious positive damage as it relates to addressing the problem of crime. As long as we're fingers, man, nothing is going to change.
Do the Pastors Network throughout the country, do you guys have conferences and networking opportunities where you can share these ideas with each other? Because it's an amazing idea. When I heard about Thrive, I thought to myself, wait a minute, why isn't that happening in Baltimore? Why isn't that happening in D.C.? Why isn't it happening? It just doesn't make any sense to me why. I just don't understand why this isn't a common thing.
Well, I think to answer your question, yes, there are, you know, conference settings where these things are discussed. I am privileged to co-chair the Sandwich with Profit Conference. And every February we gather and we have these kinds of discussions, course offerings. And so there are opportunities. I also recognize that because we are human, you have this silo over here, this silo over there, this denomination here, this denomination there. And sometimes we don't come together like we need to. And so that's one of the things that in my new capacity as president and CEO of Rainbow Push, I hope to take advantage of the fact that Reverend Jesse Jackson has always maintained a connection with the church. It's always been a faith-based movement that has crossed denominational lines. And so I think that with me being a product of the church, a faith-based activist, that I have an opportunity to expand that. And one of the things that's been really gratifying has been the fact that preachers from all over the country have been reaching out saying, hey, I'm in, whatever I can do. And these are the kinds of discussions we'll be having because, I mean, Baltimore is not alone. All over this country, wherever there is concentrated poverty, wherever there is concentrated nihilism and pessimism and despair and hopelessness, you're going to see crime and violence.
Right.
And so we have to now bring our fingers together and form a fist. And I hope we'll do that through Rainbow Push.
I hope that you do too. I really, really do. I mean, I hear people talk about the church is not giving back as much as they take in. I don't necessarily agree with that. I don't know. But I do know that the presence of the church, I think does have an effect on a community if they make their presence known. I'm trying to figure out, how do you bring more young people into the church? Do you have a recipe for that?
Well, I'll put it like this, and it's heartbreaking to me when I hear, you know, this judgment cast on a generation, you know, that's not going to church. But I would also hasten to, you know, clap back and say it's a very spiritual generation, because they are quick to say that they are not religious, but they are spiritual, meaning there is a hunger for God. And that hunger for God can be nourished and fed in settings that emphasize spiritual nourishment, or I should say a spiritual experience and nourishment that is socially, economically, and politically relevant. One of the things that, and I don't brag, I say this as a testimony, God is so good. The older I'm getting, the younger my church is getting. Every Sunday we have young people joining our church. And so I rebel against those who say young folk don't go to church. They go to church. They go to Jamal Bryant's church. They go to Jeffrey Johnson's church. I can call the roll of the churches around the country where young folk are flooding those churches because number one, the church gives them a spiritual experience, which is what they are hungry for. But then number two, the church is also socially relevant and dealing with the issues they are facing in the world. Now, if the church ain't doing that, young folk ain't going there. And then I got to say this, the other piece is, and that is young folk ain't going to a church where they walk in and the church already is living in contradistinction to Jesus saying, judge not and you won't get judged. Nobody wants to go to a church where they're getting judged and feel like they walk into a space occupied by the scribes, Pharisees, and Sadducees in the 21st century. And so if I'm walking into a church where from the pulpit to the usher board, I'm getting judged, then no, I'm not going there. But if I go to a church where all of us recognize we are struggling and striving to be who God wants us to be, if I have a spiritual experience where I feel connected with God, and if that experience is relevant to what I'm dealing with in the world out there, oh yeah, I'm gonna go to that church. And I hear young folks saying that all over this country. And so, there are folk who don't go to church, but there's a whole lot of folk going to church, and there are a lot of folk who want to go to a church that is relevant and reverent and that speaks to who they are, where they are, and at the same time is not judging them for not being perfect. The church, in too many instances, has been guilty of practicing judgment instead of love. And whenever we practice judgment instead of love, then number one, that is antichrist. Mm-hmm. And number two, real knows real. And young folk will say about that, you know, to hell with it.
Right. Right. I'm glad you brought up the whole judgment piece, because you're right. Judgment and hypocrisy are two of the biggest things that I hear as to why young people or people in general are either walking out of the church or not going into the church. And so speaking of that, you have people right now, young people, who are struggling with their identity, right? Their sexual identity. Mm-hmm. How do you welcome that into the church? How do you feel about that as far as that the LGBTQ community being in a church? How do you feel about that?
I mean, I hope they are, because number one, if we are practicing the love of Jesus Christ, we are going to not only provide that space for them to work through whatever they are working through. Okay. If we don't do that, then the world will provide that space for them. And God forbid that they have to leave church in order to find out who they are when we claim as a church to be worshiping the creator and sustainer of life. And how can I know what I am made for and who I am made to be if I'm not in relationship with my maker? So for me, the church ought to be that space, that safe space, where regardless of your struggle, yeah, I can come to church, not feel judged, but instead feel like this is a space for me to not only be loved, but a space for me that is safe for me to work through what I'm going through and find out who I was made to be, what I was made to do because of my connection with my maker. Now, I'm not saying it's easy, because it's not, but I am saying if we all come at it from a place of love, the love of God expressed in Jesus Christ and how that love showed up in the ministry of Jesus Christ. If we get that right, then, you know, the church can truly be the church.
Okay. I got one with a question to ask you, and this is kind of interesting to me. The divorce rate among black women is 5-1, meaning for every one black woman that's being married, there are five that are going through a divorce, all right, in this country. It is the highest rate of divorce among any other demographic in the country. Also, the attendance rate for black women in the church to men is 7-1. For every one black man in the church, there's seven black women. Now, I don't know if that's just a population thing or if it's a Christianity thing. When you are in the pulpit as a pastor in your church or when anywhere else you might go, do you have any messages for young women as to how important marriages are and two parent households are? It just seems that it's completely being lost. And I'm not blaming it on women, but I'm just saying that the divorce rate is very, very high among Black women, and I'm just trying to find out why.
Yeah, so, and I think that's something that will have to be, you know, thoroughly researched because, A, I don't blame it. I mean, because since it takes two to tango, if it's high among Black women, they divorcing somebody.
Yo, definitely.
So, huh?
Definitely, you're right.
Right, so I would want to know, okay, not only why is it high among Black women, but also who they are divorcing. And then as we dig deeper, you know, we are in a different time that, you know, love has been often defined by what we see projected through media, be it social media or, you know, the medium of movies and television. And as a consequence, whereas I grew up in a time where love was defined as commitment, mm-hmm. that may not necessarily be the case right now. And I think that this is a long conversation that, you know, is not going to be, you know, handled today.
Right.
But it's a long conversation whereby I think it's just going to take a serious look at what is the mindset? I'll put it to you like this. The 5-to-1 ratio is taking place, not in a vacuum, but in a culture.
Yes.
There is a culture that has created this kind of, you know, divorce rate we find ourselves experiencing. And so I think we have to not only look at the women, but look at, as I said earlier, the fact they were divorcing from someone, but also a culture that may, in a real sense, create an environment whereby there's a breakdown in families. There's a breakdown. It's been well documented, especially among the working poor, that, you know, they literally created an environment where the man was not welcome.
Correct.
In the home where the woman was.
Correct.
And so if that was being done then, and still being done, then we have to take a holistic view of things, as opposed to, okay, we're going to blame the sisters here, because I refuse to do that. Too many sisters have held too much together for us to basically say it's on them. And then I'll say this, and that is where you see the 7-to-1 ratio of women to men in churches, you also have to take a look at, okay, what's being preached and practiced in that church so that men do not feel attracted to that ministry.
Okay.
We don't have that 7-to-1 ratio at Friendship West. And I know a number of churches where the men are there strong in number and handling business. And again, Friendship West is one I'm quite proud of, because again, we try to create a climate where we believe you can affirm women and at the same time build up and liberate men to be all that God would have them to become. So I think it's always going to be, okay, what's the environment that's being created? If the environment is right, then brothers are going to be there, sisters are going to be there, and we're going to create the kind of family environment you're talking about.
I think it's very important. I myself don't attend church regularly. I'm not a member of a church. I've gone through my thing with the whole church, and I've chosen to step away. And I, like you mentioned earlier, I call myself more spiritual than religious. So I'm one of those persons, right? Although I'm not a young person, I'm one of those persons that does that. But when I did go to church, when I was in church, and I was in church heavy, when I was in church, I did find something about the church that I felt catered more to the woman than to the man. Like, we were there, but it just didn't feel like it was being catered to me as much as it was to women. And I just wondered if that is something that is that a I don't know. Is that a recipe? Is it something that's, you know, deliberate, or it's just or not?
Well, again, see, I've been really blessed. Number one, I grew up in a church where the male presence was really strong. Uh-huh. And then the people I've run with in terms of who've been influential in my ministry, Johnny Ray Youngblood in New York.
Right.
And now the church continues, St. Paul with Pastor Brawley there. Strong, strong male presence. Jeremiah Wright in Chicago. And I could call the role, E.K. Bailey here in Dallas, Texas. Those individuals were models for me for reaching especially Black men.
Okay.
And I developed a passion for reaching and ministering to Black men. And as a consequence, you know, we developed ministries here at the church that targeted reaching, discipling, empowering Black men. That for me is a priority. And again, so I can't really speak to other situations, but I can say that I've been exposed to, and as a consequence have tried to replicate in my ministry, you know, targeting our brothers, because in too many instances, you know, our brothers are walking around with the bullseye on their backs. And to be Black and male in this country is to find yourself again a target.
Yes.
For white supremacy in so many expressions and manifestations. And so if you're catching hell in the streets, you ought to at least feel like you were first class in the sanctuary.
Outstanding. Amen to that. One last question, then I'll let you go. You give me a lot of your time today. Why do you think there are not more female pastors in the church as head pastors? Why do you think that's the case?
Wow. What a question. That's an indictment on the church, because what's really sad is, and you just said it so well, you grow up in a church where the ministry caters to women until women decide that they've been called to preach, even to pastor.
Right.
And so there is a stained glass ceiling on the aspirations of women in far too many Black churches. And it is the result of a Black church that has swallowed the poison of white evangelical Christianity and white Jesus, because white Jesus is going to always be top down in terms of a hierarchy of value. Whereas when you look at our African upbringing, in terms of what's in our DNA, there's always been an egalitarian approach to community building. And so it is an indictment on any church that has a stained glass ceiling that says women can sit in the pews, they can clean the pulpit, but they cannot preach or pastor behind that pulpit in that church. And so that for me is an indictment. I'm glad to say it's getting better. It's just too slow, far too slow.
Yeah.
And you have a number of gifted women. And watch this, my brother. Here's what's interesting. When you look at who's going to seminary today, it's Black women.
Yes.
And so the future of the Black church is going to be, if you want an educated pastor, you're going to have a woman, or you're going to shut it down. And so I think it's, I don't want to say it, it's almost the judgment of God on a church that turned its back on half of the population that God created and the majority of those who attend our Black churches. And yet you say, okay, you can do this, but you cannot aspire to do that. If God calls you to do that, you still can't do it, because we ain't going to let you become what God has called you to become. So it's slowly changing, but the pace needs to pick up.
Well, on that note, I'm going to let you run. Reverend Dr. Freddie Haynes III, thank you so, so, so much for being with me today. I know my listeners got a kick out of it. It's a very joyous occasion to have you here. And I hope to be able to call on you again. There's still so much to talk about.
I look forward to it. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, sir. You take care of yourself now. You ever been inspired by somebody after a conversation who has no idea that they've inspired you? Well, this is one of those situations. I just want to do so much now, you know what I mean? But listen, I know you hear the music. That could only mean one thing on this show. It is time for the Petty. So let's give the Petty a call and see what he's got for us this week.
Brother B, good morning. Happy Sunday to you.
Same to you, Petty. How you doing today, bro?
I'm doing just fantastic. The weather's fine. The sun is shining. And all's good up here in Philadelphia. How's it down there in Birdland?
Hey, man.
Should I say Birdland? Or should I say Baltimore?
It's great down here.
You know what? I was starting to get excited because preseason started. And for me, it's the beginning of the football season. But then I started thinking, preseason is not what it used to be when the first team would play the first half, the first quarter, the first series. And now it's like second and third stringers, mostly guys who are fighting for a position on the team. So I'm really not following it the way that I usually would. I'm looking at some of the games. I'm seeing a lot of the starters in street clothes. They're not even suited up in pads or anything. They're carrying clipboards, wearing headsets. So it's kind of hard to get excited about the preseason, even though I am excited that the football season has officially started.
I mean, I know you're excited about the camps, though. You're always excited about the camps because you like to see who's where and who's, you know, that kind of thing. So I know that excites you.
Well, I'm excited because I'm looking at who's getting injured and the impact it'll have on the teams moving forward in the future.
Right.
That's what I'm looking at more than anything. For the first time, I'm looking at who may or may not be starting for certain teams and how much of an impact it'll have on those teams moving forward into the season. But you know what? Let's talk about those birds. Let's talk about those high-flying O's. And if you recall, Brother B, I have been talking about them all season long.
Yes, you have.
They have done something that I didn't think they were going to do. They've overtaken the Rays to be the beast of the American League East. As a matter of fact, they are the beast of the American League. They hold the second-best record in baseball, only second to the Atlanta Braves, and that says a lot. And I recall the series that the Braves and the Orioles had early this season, and man, it was a bomb burner. Those guys, both of those teams, played excellent ball, and I saw some things. And I mean, they played one game and then they went to extra innings, and it was just fantastic. I mean, if you're a baseball fan, you had to love it. And I'm telling you right now, Baltimore, anyone that's in the sound that can hear my voice, you got to go out there and support those O's. I mean, you guys have been supporting those bum bird Ravens for who knows how long.
You've been walking around Baltimore
with their purple, black, and gold.
Be careful.
And they have done anything. They've done nothing but made you angry. That's why I call them angry birds, because they make everybody angry. Now you got the O's. There used to be a time when the O's used to be the talk of the town. Everybody donned the orange and black. And I think those days have come back. Not to mention my man, Seti, he is back.
He's off the DL list.
And I'm glad to hear that he will be back playing again. But you know, when there's something good going on, there's got to be a little something behind the scenes that kind of try to stir things up.
Like
I'm talking about some things that were said early in the week behind one of the announcers. He made a true fact. He talked about something that was true.
Yeah.
And he wasn't bashing the team. He wasn't saying anything.
He got fired too, though, didn't he?
Well, no, it's kind of like a brief suspension. Kevin Brown will be back. He'll be back doing the play-by-play. But he put something out there that was true. It wasn't bashing the O's. It wasn't trying to cause any kind of dissension. It's just, it was a true statement.
What did he say? Something like
what he said is that they don't hold a positive or good record against the Tampa Bay Rays. And if you go back through the history of the Orioles and look at their record, they don't. So he didn't say anything bad. Yeah, he put a little something on it, but you know, he spoke the truth. So ownership wasn't too happy about it, especially with how well they're doing right now. So they feel like, you know what, we're gonna give a little slap on the wrist, give you a couple of days off. But everything from what he said, it's all good. So from what I understand, he'll be back in the booth doing play-by-play.
Okay. All right.
And that's a good thing. And like I said, those guys, you got to go out and support. You know, they're doing the good things. They will be in the playoffs. You know, there'll be some games.
Did they clinch the playoff spot?
Listen, Brother B, let me tell you something. They are the second-best team in baseball. They will be in the playoffs.
Listen,
something's going to be happening in Baltimore that hasn't happened in quite some time. There will be baseball in October in Baltimore.
Okay. I mean, you count your chickens before they hatch, which isn't something you typically do. So,
But you know what, Brother B? I've been hearing it all season long. Well, I don't know about those Orioles, and they have been riding this thing since, I would have to say, mid-April, early May. They just been riding. I think they're going to keep on riding that wave, and there will be baseball in Baltimore in October.
Okay. All right. I'll take your word for it. I wonder what the ticket prices are going to jump up to. You know what I mean?
Oh, my goodness. They are going to be astronomically high. And, you know, I just can't see, unless I win the lottery or Mega Millions or Powerball, I can't see myself going to any one of those playoff games or even the World Series game unless that happens. But I definitely will be tuning in, if not on my TV, definitely on my phone, on my radio, something. I want to keep up with those high-flying birds.
Well, I got a guy that I was in kindergarten with named Vernon Keeps, and he has season tickets. So, Vernon, if you're listening, bro, hook me up. You know what I mean?
That's right. Hook the brothers up. Hook us up. We need a hookup.
Absolutely. Hey, did you hear about Clarissa Shields challenging Keith Thurman to a fight?
I think that's ridiculous. You know what? There have been some things going on with this male-female thing, the gender thing in boxing, and I'm dare to say professional wrestling, because we know that that's
stage.
You know what? I'm not going to kill for all the fans. Anyway, I've heard it. I think that it's ludicrous. It's ridiculous. Stick to what you know. But speaking of Clarissa Shields, she just signed a multi-year deal to continue fighting MMA.
Yeah, no, and I think that's a mistake.
Well, she says she wants to be a champ not only in female boxing but also in MMA. And you know what? Let her go ahead and see what she can do. She's already taken a loss. And, you know, mainly because her ground game is not what it should be. You know, she's a striker, but you got to have a ground game. You got to be able to, you know, pick them up, put them down, be able to get out of certain holes. And when someone takes you down, be able to bounce back from that. And when I saw her last bout in the octagon, she didn't look all that sharp. She was definitely a good striker, but the other person was an MMA fighter who had a whole lot more experience than she did. And you can see it. So, you know, if anybody really kind of wants to know what she's doing in the MMA, go to YouTube, check out some, you know, she's only had two fights in the MMA. But look at both of them. And, you know, you can see that she's definitely just she's a fighter. She's a boxer.
She's a boxer. But, and you know what, man? You see football players that play golf. You see basketball players that play golf. What you don't see is baseball players playing golf. And you know why? Because it affects their swing, right?
Of course.
Same thing I feel with MMA and boxing. Yeah, they're both contact sports, but one is completely different from the other. And your mental is completely different in one than the other. And I think she's trying to serve too many masters. I don't think she should pollute her boxing game with MMA.
Well, you know what? Let's just see and hope that her MMA game doesn't affect her boxing.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Because it could have a negative effect on her boxing. She's such a great female boxer.
Right.
And I think that's what she should stay with.
That's what I'm saying. I agree 100%.
No, that's what I really think should go on. Speaking of great things that have happened, and I'm telling you, Brother B, you had to see it, you had to listen to it, and it doesn't happen too often, but when it does, it's a wonderful thing. Up here in Philadelphia, the Phillies, they got a guy through a trade, I believe on August the 1st or August the 2nd.
Right.
He pitched for them while they were on the road, and he pitched 8 strong innings. They gave up a couple of runs. They won the game. Well, he had his first home game with the Phillies here in Philadelphia, and he pitches a no-hitter.
Oh, wow.
This was incredible. He just got traded to the team in his second start in the Phillies uniform. He throws a no-hitter in Philadelphia.
Wow. I mean, you guys, hold up now, because you guys just had a guy brought up from AAA, too, that had been down there for like 7 years, and in his first at-bat, he cranked a home run.
Exactly. That night, and it all happened in the same game.
Are you serious?
Look, he comes to bat, his first at bat, he's 28 years old. He thought he would probably be a career minor league player because he's been in the minor leagues like forever. He's 28, his first game, first major league game.
in the team that he's playing for in their home stadium, first at bat, he cranks one out. And I mean, it was a moonshot.
Yeah.
He crushed it. Then you got the guy comes in his first home game after being traded to the Phillies. He pitches a no-hitter.
And that was in the same game?
Same game.
Wow. Oh,
not to mention one of their other players, who was much has been much maligned over the last several weeks, he comes in and gets his 199th and 200th home run. All these things happen in the same game. So, you know, the people up here in Philadelphia just going crazy over the Phillies right now.
Yeah,
they're talking about they might go back to the World Series, and the Phillies are looking good. So they might surprise a lot of teams in the National League. I don't hear too much of them talking about any other team as much as they're talking about the Phillies right now. The pitching's coming together. The hitting is just like, man, it's there.
Wow.
You know, and you know what? Speaking of which, let's go back to the Orioles. Because when I was talking about the Orioles earlier this year, everybody was talking about, well, you know, they're pitching. We don't know who these guys are. They have been doing some good things. The hitting is there. It's timely. The pitching is starting to come along. And I remember you saying, I don't know none of these guys' names. Who are they?
Right, right.
Well, we're starting to get to know them now. We're starting to see some of the things that they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, they're mentioning their names all the time, like Hayes and Mateo and Mullins. And yeah, I mean, it's definitely something that's becoming familiar to everybody in Baltimore.
And you know, I'm talking a lot of baseball right now because that's the hottest thing that's going on right now.
Right.
You know, there's a young man in Cincinnati. I'm going to switch cities a little bit right here. Ellie De La Cruz.
Oh,
you got to look at some of his stuff. This dude is fire.
He's a beast. He's a beast.
He's a beast. I don't know where they found this young man from.
He was in their farm system. He was in their farm system.
But where did they find him? That's what I'm saying.
And
you know what? A lot of teams are building their teams through free agency. It's very good to find someone like this young man in your farm system that comes up through the ranks. And then he's a high prospect. You know, they talk about him. This young man could possibly do this. And then he comes up to here, ends the big show, the majors, and he gets it done.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he had a game where he stole second, third, and home.
And three consecutive pitches. And I'm telling you, Brother B, it was so exciting. I think I watched that thing about 10 times.
Yeah, he's a beast.
Or more. And when you get to the very last one where he steals home, you really have to watch it more than twice to see that he realized that I'm going to steal it because they're not paying attention.
They were lollygagging. They weren't paying attention.
And it was just amazing, you know, to see that. And then he's cranking out bombs of home. He hit a home run over 425 feet recently.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the guy is just fast. And he's fast.
They checked his bat.
He's a good third baseman. He's got a bat. This young man in the future, man, the Reds have really found a gem with him.
Yeah, they have.
You know, so,
you know, the joke is he'll be playing for the Yankees next year. That's the joke.
I don't know about that one. You know what? Speaking of the Yankees, they're already looking forward to next year. They feel as though they have no chance of even making the playoffs.
Yeah. Judge was a dud this year, so, you know.
I'm just, you know, it's time for some new blood in there. I'm glad to see the Orioles are doing well. It looks like Tampa fell. By the way, just as their brethren down in Florida, the Panthers, when they lost in the hockey,
and
the Heat, when they lost in the NBA, it's like the Rays are doing the same thing. It seems like it's the sun is coming down. It's going down on the teams from Florida. So we'll see what happens with the Dolphins and the Buccaneers and the Jaguars in the NFL this season. And maybe it's a bad luck year for the Florida teams. We shall see.
Yes, we shall.
I really don't have too much, Brother B, except for I promise you, I'm going to do my homework, keep my ear to the ground, and we're going to start talking about these divisions and breaking down the AFC and the NFC and who could possibly come out on top. I'm going to give you some injury reports next week, and I got to get out of here because, like I said, I got to start doing my homework, put my ear to the ground, and give you a little bit more because the football season is here, and we're going to start talking more and more about the NFL.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Out of here, Brother B.
Appreciate
you.
Peace, brother. Well, there you go. There's the petty being the petty. Please take heed. He is hyped about summer camp and the preseason games, as I am. I'm also hyped, and I'm also hyped about the O's. So, I'm on the train with them, so to speak. And we will see what the season will bring for both the O's and the Ravens and the other teams that he mentioned, of course. They're just as important. Now, every week I ask you guys to hit me up on IG to, you know, give me your feedback about something that I've spoken about on the show or ask me any questions that you have. And true to form, Sonia Scott Bushrod, one of my greatest supporters, sent me a message on IG that I wanted to read to you guys. And it says, I got to talk about that Trump. I will never understand why he hasn't been charged for murder and attempted murder. People were hurt and killed, as you know. I'm happy to know that they are shooting for and I think will get a speedy trial. If Trump is convicted, I understand that he gets to appeal it. And she goes on to write that she believes the conviction alone should disqualify him from running for president. And I agree 100%. And I, like you, Sonia, will never understand why he hasn't been in handcuffs long before this. But, you know, again, I'm not a judge. And I'm not a politician, but, you know, sense makes sense to me. And for what he's done to this country that they already have on video and audio tape, anybody else, I believe, would have been under the jail by now. But it's Donald Trump. But thank you, Sonia, for the message. I look forward to more comments from anybody and everybody on IG and on with Brian Pettaway. And if you've missed any of these shows, you can always go to my website, voiceswired.com, hit on the Let's Talk tab, and you will see all the shows listed there for the most recent to the oldest show. So please go to voiceswired.com and check them out. Also, before I go, I want to send a special shout out to the birthday girl, my Aunt Clara. It's her 80th. I got an opportunity to spend a brief moment with the party girl this weekend at her 80th birthday party downtown near the harbor. And if there was ever a person that partied like it was still 1999, it is Aunt Clara. She is vibrant. She is rolling. And I am so happy that she's in my life. So thank you, Aunt Clara, and happy birthday. Again, I want to thank the Reverend Dr. Freddie Haynes III for joining me today and being my guest. It was a huge honor to be able to speak with him today and have him drop the knowledge on me that he did. I always enjoy speaking to wise people, people I can learn from, and I did learn some things from him today. Also, I want to thank you for joining me today. It's always a pleasure being with you as well, and you giving up your Sunday morning for that hour. I really appreciate it. I don't take it for granted. Listen, people, today is a day of rest. Make sure you get your rest in, you sleep, you nap, whatever you got to do, but do nothing. Do nothing today. But the best thing about doing nothing, I always say, is you can quit whenever you want. So tomorrow morning, wake up, be refreshed, conquer the world, have the best day, have the best week that you can possibly have, and thank God for being alive. I got to go, people. I'll see you next week right here at 10 a.m. Peace.